Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. And I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my pleasure to introduce Joseph Rodota, who is the author of The Watergate, Inside America's Most Infamous Address, the history of the building and the people who inhabited it even before it became infamously famous. So I can see, and it's very nice to see, people under 65 years of age here in the audience to find out what happened when we were all young. So, Joseph, thank you very much for coming. It's yours.
Great. Thanks. Great. Thank you, George. And thank you, everybody, for coming. The reviews of the book's been out since February. And one of the early reviews described it as an unlikely combination of campy political gossip and erudite architectural exploration. So with a show of hands, who is here for campy political gossip? Who is here for erudite architectural exploration? And who's here for campy architectural gossip? I wish Stefan from Saturday Night Live did book reviews, because I would have asked him to do a blurb that said, "This book has everything." So I got the idea for the book while I was living in Washington, D.C. For about 4 years, and actively looking for stories within Washington that I could take and do something with, either create a play. I was involved with developing a play at the time. Or a book or something else. And I had this idea that somewhere buried in the archives of Washington was a great story. Or I could file a Freedom of Information Act request at some agency and get 20,000 pages of documents, and there would be my story, and there would be my Pulitzer and my Oscar, and we'd just be done with it. It would all be set. And so as I was in that mode looking for a story, I was heading to the Kennedy Center and passed by the Watergate. It was a beautiful, sunny evening. And probably because I was just in that mode of looking around for ideas, and I passed the building I'd passed by many times before, but I was looking at it in a new light. And I went back to the office. I was like, I was thinking that night, well, maybe my book or my story is hiding in plain sight. And I went to the office the next day and started poking around and discovered two things. One was, if you put in Watergate into Amazon, you'd get like more than 1,000 hits. But all of those hits were about the break-in, various aspects of the break-in. Nothing was written about the book, the place itself, the stage on which this took place. And there are books, as you know, lots of books about buildings. There's books about all the major apartment buildings in New York, about American castles. There's all these places in America that inspired books over the years, but nobody had written about the Watergate. And then the second thing, when I started poking around, is it looked like there were a lot of really interesting people who lived there. Some of them connected to the Nixon years, but actually I was sort of struck by how many people outside of that era had passed through the Watergate at one point or another. So some really consequential, interesting folks who I'll talk about in a second. So I wrote up the idea, and I was fortunate as HarperCollins agreed with me, and I started working on the book in 2015 in the fall. And at the time, this is about, and it's 2015, that's the 50th anniversary of the opening of the first building in the Watergate. And if you look on the screen, it's sort of the building tucked in the back behind that sort of horseshoe-shaped building which is the last building built. Right behind it is the first building, Watergate East. And I thought, wow, you know, I get this idea for the book, and it's the 50th anniversary, and I don't have the book. And I just felt, I felt like a real dummy. I missed my moment, right? But I decided to go ahead and just keep working on it. And then President Trump fired James Comey. And the searches, if you poke around Google Trends, people became very interested in Watergate. The word Watergate started being plugged into search engines again. This became this sort of nostalgia around the Watergate era, in that people were looking for stories about the country as it went through this time of remarkable political turmoil and day-to-day drama, both legal and political, and a sense of you just didn't really know what was going to happen next. And Slate came out with a Slow Burn, its podcast, which was excellent, and shot to number one. George Clooney is doing a Watergate documentary or film for Netflix. And so I ended up thinking the timing ended up being just fine. So I did get my wish. I did get to poke around in the archives. Not only in the National Archives in Washington, but the book came together from about 13 different presidential libraries, starting with FDR. I also went to Rome. I'm working on my book about the Watergate, and I'm off to Rome. People thought, wow, writing book, that is just a scam. The files for the company that built the Watergate, which is an Italian company, no longer existed in the United States. I don't know where they went. I hope if anybody's listening or anybody in the room knows where they went, give me a call. But I found the files in Rome. And the company that built the Watergate, and this is one of the first surprises in the story for me, was an Italian company named Società Generale Immobiliare. I don't pronounce it as well as Bronson Pinchot does on the audiobook, but it was one of the great companies of Italy, and maybe one of the great companies of all of Europe, founded in 1862 in Turin, relocated to Rome in 1870 as the Kingdom of Italy is formed, and was this giant in Italian real estate and the development and construction. And they are the company that bought the land and decided to put this complex, which you're seeing, on these 10 acres. They bought the land from the Washington Gaslight Company. This is a former, very derelict industrial site along the Potomac where for decades coal was brought up the Potomac, turned into gas, and then sent through the gas pipes of Washington, D.C. to light the streets. And then when the country shifted to natural gas, that process was no longer needed, and so the land was surplus. So in Rome, found the files, and I think I was the first person to look at these files since they ended up in the possession of the Italian government, because the rust was still intact on the paper clips. And so at the end of the day, there was rust everywhere, and I thought that was actually a pretty good sign. Several of the residents who lived at the Watergate and worked in various presidential administrations, for example, Maurice Stans, who was the finance chief for Nixon, left their personal files to their alma mater. So scattered around the country were the files of some of these people who lived there, including Claire Booth Luce, Anna Chenault, and Maurice Stans and others. And so they actually had files in the finding. It said Watergate, you know, or building. And so you could actually see, I could see, you know, how they were interacting with the building, even though I didn't have access to the minutes directly from the different cooperative associations. I could get the story that way. And then I also I had this system, my researchers and I, where we would reach out any time we came across a name connected to the Watergate, we'd Google this person, see if they were alive, call, write, or email. If they were dead, get the obituary, find the children, call, write, or email. And so I was able to track down some documents from people who are no longer with us, including at the time the unpublished memoir of a guy named Nicholas Salgo, who actually found the land for the Italians. And so I got to his story of how the Watergate came together. And then this family based in Atlanta, the Bradleys. Betty Bradley is in the book. She was the first woman concierge of the Watergate Hotel. And she'd given one or two interviews, maybe about 20 years ago, something like that. And that looked really interesting, so I tried to track her down. And so I got a call from this man who identified himself as Lee Bradley. And he said, unfortunately, Mom didn't leave really any clippings or files, but she left us a box of tapes. And when you're writing a book about the Watergate, those are really good words to hear. And sure enough, it was a box of audio tapes. Somebody had interviewed Betty and her sassy sidekick, Jimmy, back in the day. And they were all just sitting around smoking for hours and hours, talking smack about Watergate guests and their coworkers and all. And so I digitized them and sent them back to the family, sent the box and then also the digitized version. So they got to hear Mom's sassiness. And she told some really terrific stories that are in the book about what it was like to be running the front desk of probably the most interesting Washington hotel of its era. I did have the opportunity to do some really fun interviews. So I interviewed, I'll tell you about a couple of them, a guy named Giuseppe Cecchi. He was a young man in Rome. And when he heard that his company was going to start expanding into North America and they were looking for somebody to go into the U.S. office, which they thought would be New York, he volunteered because he was single and he knew a little bit of English. And so I sat down with him several times and heard about the, you know, this guy's like in his mid to late 20s at the time. And he saw the Watergate sort of all the way through its early years. And the family did not have any paperwork from that day, but I found memos to and from or about Giuseppe in Rome. And so he told me the story when I was sitting and talking about him about the Democratic National Committee and the break-in, because I really wanted to get a sense of what was it like to be there, like the day before, the during, you know, that. And he just shook his head and he said, you know, I was trying to evict them. So what happened was, is the Democratic National Committee, which was in Watergate office building, So if you look in the center where there's that, like, that building, the middle building that's sort of pointing to the water, that's the hotel. And behind it is the office building where the break-in occurred. And they are connected. Looks like they're, when you see them, it looks like they're connected, but they're only really connected underground through the parking structures. Right? So the Democrats were chronically behind on their rent. And so Giuseppe had just had enough, and he wanted them out. And he, this is 1972, and he asked for permission from Rome to get rid of them, to begin eviction proceedings. And the word came back, absolutely not. This may be the party of the next president of the United States. And so he said, we will just start the eviction after the election. He held his fingers up and he said, I just came this close. We could have been spared all of these troubles. He didn't have any big recollections of the day that he heard about the break-in. That actually is more dramatic when I got it from other people. But he did report that they had a spectacular problem with theft in the Watergate Hotel immediately following the break-in. Anything that had the word Watergate on it was stolen. And he, including $4,000 worth of towels in the first month. And he said, we had to go with anonymous towels. And that actually becomes a problem later on when the hotel's contents are liquidated for a renovation, and there's very little with the word Watergate on it, which cuts into the liquidation proceeds. I also interviewed a guy named R. Spencer Oliver. Spencer was the occupant of one of the two offices that were bugged by the burglars. And he actually negotiated the lease to move the Democrats into this luxury building in 1967. So got the story of how they got into the building. And then I interviewed the last person to leave the Democratic National Committee headquarters prior to the break-in. And that was Bruce, the summer intern. His name is Bruce Givner, 21-year-old UCLA intern. And it was late on Friday night, and he was hanging out in the Democratic National Committee offices. Everybody else had gone home. He doesn't know it, but he is being observed from across the way by Alfred Baldwin with binoculars in the Howard Johnsons. And what Bruce is doing is he is using the free telephone, the Watts line, to call friends and family back in Lanier, Ohio. And so the whole time he's being monitored, he learns later. And he said, I only took a break once to leave the office, go out on the terrace and relieve myself in a potted plant. And then I went back in and I made some more phone calls. It's tragic that radio conversation wasn't preserved. I interviewed Sally Quinn, and she is the wife of Ben Bradley, the famous executive managing editor of the Washington Post. And she shows up in the book twice as a young writer. With the Washington Post, she was in the style section, which was this sassy, hip coverage of cool life in Washington that was launched by the Post and covering sort of more of the social scene. And Sally was sent around to cover parties, and she covered parties at the Watergate, including the parties of the famous Anna Chenault. And then during the Nixon Watergate. Maelstrom, I guess I use Maelstrom. During the Nixon meltdown, Ben left his wife and got an apartment in the Watergate. And as he put in his autobiography, somehow I found myself single and in the Watergate during Watergate. And Sally moved in with him, and they were there just for a few months, but they kept running into Nixon aides in the elevator and in the garage. And so it was sort of this really interesting moment. And there's some other stories in the book of what is it like to have been in the Watergate and to run into these people in the hall that you are reading about. And of course, in Ben's case, you're actually driving the story. Sally said that Ben was under enormous stress, as you can imagine. And so part of the way he dealt with it is to go out to the farm in West Virginia and chop things, bury things, saw things, haul things around. And so once they're on the elevator, and they're both in jeans and work shirts, and Ben has all these, this big length of heavy chain wrapped around his shoulders, and he's in the elevator. And the elevator opens, and one of Nixon's chief media defenders, Victor Lasky, sees them and walks in the elevator. This is a Nixon White House staffer, and he turns to Ben Bradley and says, "Jesus, Bradley, are you into that?" And then I got to interview Bob Dole. Bob Dole, which is one of the things I thought was really strange. Bob Dole was Bob Dole's next door neighbor, Bob and Elizabeth Dole. Their next door neighbor, Monica Lewinsky, lived next door. At the time it was funny. This is 2 years after he is lost to Clinton, and he reads in the paper that Clinton has had an affair with an intern. Monica Lewinsky lives at the Watergate, and he has two thoughts, he says. One is, where was Gordon Liddy when I needed him? And two, if we bought that apartment you know, if they ever move, and at that moment, I just thought, you know, everybody in every building is the same. You know, they read the obituaries, they read the news, and they think, like, that's just a tragedy, and we need a larger kitchen. So what happened was Bob and Elizabeth bought the apartment. Thereafter, when they combined it with their own, the way the Watergate happens to be built, you can't go up or down. The building is built if that the structure of it is such that you can only buy your neighbors left or right. And then Bob, when he would give tours, he would gesture grandly to that end of the apartment, say, "This is Monica Land." And then during the actual Monica Lewinsky era, there was the Monica watch was out in front of Watergate South, and so he would go out and clown, and basically he's a funny guy, so he would just make jokes with them. Usually he would pretend he thought they were all there to see him, and on Mondays he would hand out donuts. He was a spokesman for Dunkin' Donuts, so he would hand out donuts to the press, the Monica watch, on Mondays, and try out some new jokes. He tells the story. I was sitting there in his office. He has two assistants, and he tells a story about walking into Monica's apartment after it has been purchased. When he finally gets the key, he walks into Monica's bedroom. So Monica lived there with the mother, Marcia Lewis. Marcia had moved to New York by then, so Monica was the only resident. And so he said, and then I walked into her bedroom, and I could just, these poor aides, I'm a former political aide, so I just saw it coming, and they just sort of cringing, like, please, I hope the boss has a filter. And he comes pretty close, but he said it was sort of in disarray, and left on the wall was a photograph of a man with an obscenity written across the image. And he said, and I probably should have saved it. It might be worth something. And I can just imagine him going back to home to Elizabeth Dole and say, hey, you know, I got this amazing picture. And Mrs. Dole, who's not known for being humorous. If it got that far, she would have made sure it was gone. The book is a biography of a building. So I kind of went into this thinking, I'm telling the story of a place as if it was a person, and I want to talk about it from birth, you know, how the parents meet, from birth. We sort of know, if you think of it as a person, it's like basically now between like 48 and 52 years old or so, and is known primarily for its awkward teenage years. We kind of have this sort of image of the place driven by, you know, what happened there and how that changes Washington, changes the country, changes the political vocabulary, of course, changes life in the building. And in my perception of the building, apart from seeing it, like when I first arrived in Washington as a summer intern, was I just thought had a really a black and white crime scene kind of feel for the place. You know, we all sort of saw it in the news in the background as, you know, the country is unraveling. And so what I tried to do is like tell the whole story of the life of this building, and of course it's filled with people and. And so their biographies are sort of keeps the story moving as well. One way to think of the Watergate is it is Washington's freshman dorm. And by that I mean, you know, people are new people coming and going, but also it's part pressure cooker and part fishbowl. And so a lot of really interesting people live there, some temporary coming in and going throughout with various administrations, and others permanent, some socialites, some CIA folks, a lot of international people. And it just kind of has this sort of lively life of interesting people coming and going. And the perspective I give the reader is the purchasing. When the building first opened, you could get a junior one-bedroom apartment for $17,500. And so that's the perspective of the building. I give the reader a junior one-bedroom. in 1965. And so I think put myself in that room, and like, what would I pay attention to over 50 years? So for people in the room, I'm going to explain left to right, the Watergate that you're seeing on the screen. Far left, so the Watergate big picture is 10 acres. It was designed as a city within a city. That's actually what they called it in its marketing material. 1965. So this is not when cities were cool and hip. This is when cities were a little frightening to people. And if you wanted a modern, safe life, you left and went to the suburbs. The suburbs were where everything was new. You have the new mid-century modern house. Your post office was new. Your school was new. Everything. You had you just drive around in your 1962 Buick, and you just think your life is great. And the cities were sort of a little bit dangerous, but also sort of old and stale. And this was designed to reverse that. And so this is a very modern, convenient way of living. It's one of the first multi-use developments in the country, first certainly in Washington. And it includes a hotel. So left to right is the first apartment building on the left. That is Watergate West. And then in front of it is the Watergate Hotel. Behind the Watergate Hotel, as I mentioned, is the Watergate office building. To the right of that is Watergate East, which is the first apartment building. And then in front of everything, where you see sort of curb building on one side, is Watergate South, which is an apartment building, a co-op. They're all co-op apartments. And on the right is Watergate 600, which is an office building, headquarters of Atlantic Media now. All the parking is underneath. All the trees are placed on top of columns that support the parking structure. In its heyday, it had a Safeway, drugstore, post office, banks, art gallery, pastry shop, wine shop, beauty salon. It sort of had everything. Had three psychiatrists, which obviously came in handy. And it was also a lot of embassy personnel. There was chanceries there, and ambassadors, and top embassy staff sort of scattered about. At the time, in the Nixon years, which was sort of the heyday, in 1969, Life magazine did an 8-page color spread about life at the Watergate. I'm going to show you some pictures of it from that article in a minute. And summarized it as, this is summer 69, so it's the footprints of the first moonwalker on the cover, and to give it context. And the headline was, "It used to be Georgetown, now it's Watergate, just everybody lives there." And so, and it really was like this pinnacle of luxury and privacy and modernism. And I thought I would tell you three stories and then show you a couple of slides, and then that should leave time for questions. But some of the surprises that I came across as I was working on the book, maybe two stories. And I mentioned earlier that the book, the Watergate, comes from an Italian company, initials SGI. If you've been to Washington, you've seen the Watergate, you notice that it just doesn't really look like anything else in Washington. And so when the design for this appears in print and is revealed to the public and to the permitting authorities that have control over the Watergate, they more or less freak out. It's too strange. It doesn't look like anything else in town. It's designed to be... original design is much bigger, and it's on this prominent piece of land that somehow like had slipped by everybody and now is in the hands of a private company that had these dramatic plans. And then in 1964, in the middle of this fight, the Washington Post reveals that the lead investor in this company is the Vatican. And because they are the largest shareholder of SGI with 4 seats on the board, and this lights up the Protestants. So there was a group called Protestants and Other Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. And I found in the Kennedy Library Bobby Kennedy's file on them. They were putting out brochures during the 1960 campaign, roughly suggesting that if push came to shove and a Catholic president was forced to choose between the Pope and you, the Catholic president's going to go with the Pope. And so when this appears in the press, this organization lights up and begins stirring up their membership. And I thought I would read from one of their newsletters. What is, you can't see is that the title of it is called The Eyes of America, and it's a picture of this massive Watergate towering over the tiny Lincoln Memorial, which is a couple miles away. And here's the problem, as in this newsletter. Laws protecting the beauty of our capital have been bypassed so the owners of Watergate Town, a Vatican showcase, can have taller buildings and a better return on their investment of $75 million. Società Generale Immobiliare, a Rome-based Vatican-created corporation, mounted such pressures that the government yielded. Future picture postcards of the free world's capital may well show a skyline dominated by a monument to a clerical system which, unrestrained, has crushed freedom in other lands.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And then the letters start coming into the White House. And so I found in the Kennedy Library, and there's an excerpt in the book, is this memo from a guy named Charles Horsky to Kennedy saying, we got a problem, here's what's happening, believe it or not, the Watergate is generated hate mail, and here's how I'm planning to do about it. But I thought I would bring one letter from that it was in the White House file from March of 63. And this writer says, the thing that thousands of people are disturbed about is the Roman Catholic Church erecting a shrine to honor their specific religion and placing it in the capital of the greatest nation on earth, so it will be an advertisement to their specific religion. I am persuaded that both you and Mr. Kennedy and all of the Roman Catholics who are concerned with this building are aware of the complaint we are making. If the Roman Catholic Church had one spark of Christianity about it, they would not force this building on the American people. So it's pretty wild. And so basically the Watergate is controversial before it's even built, is sort of the lesson of that. And that's eventually it gets resolved. The designs are modified and construction's underway. The building opens in a black tie, a fantastic event, black tie party to announce the building in 1965. And then people over time start moving into the various buildings. I thought I would read from part of the book about, it's from July of 1967. So I'll give you one Democratic story from the book and one Republican story from the book. And so this is about July of 1967, and it's about the Democrats moving in to the Watergate office building. In July 1967, President and Mrs. Johnson attended the open house at the DNC's new Watergate offices. Bailey, that's John Bailey, the head of the party, showed the president the computer room. Upstairs, Lady Bird Johnson admired the view but expressed concerns about the 220-foot-high smokestacks that marred the otherwise picture-perfect view of Georgetown from DNC Vice Chairman Margaret Price's office. The First Lady was in the midst of a national beautification initiative and was happy to learn the unsightly structures were about to come down. No one told her a freeway would replace them. Some of the party faithful were uneasy, even sheepish, as they tried to reconcile the new offices. with their wall-to-wall carpeting, art and tapestry-lined walls, pastel push-button telephones, and VIP room with a built-in sink and refrigerator, with the common man image of the New Deal, the Fair Deal, and the Great Society, the Washington Star reported. It looks like Republican headquarters, observed Johnson's Labor Secretary Willard Wirtz, only half in jest. Nothing's too good for the party of the people, said Associate Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. According to the Miami Herald, the music is soft and piped. The girls look like they escaped from a James Bond movie. There's a great view of the Potomac, too. And real or contrived, happiness pervades the sixth floor ultra-modern suite. And then I have, I start the book on Friday, the morning of June 16th, which is June 16th, 1972. And I was able to piece together what a lot of the people living in the Watergate were doing that day from their diaries and news reports and what was happening in the Watergate. And this is the Friday of the break-in. And it's really the sort of the last day that life in the Watergate is what everybody expected when they bought their apartments. and then thereafter, you know, the place changes. But I thought maybe I read a little bit about the morning of Saturday, June 17th. So at around 12:30 a.m. on Saturday, June 17th, Frank Wills, that's the famous security guard, took a call from his supervisor, Bobby Jackson. Wills explained he had discovered and removed tape on the stairwell doors, and Jackson directed him to check the other doors in the building and report back. Wills hung up and finished his cheeseburger and fries. At around 1:10 a.m., the five-man entry team, Sturgis, Barker, Martinez, Gonzalez, and McCord, arrived at the door on the B2 level of the underground garage and discovered the tape was missing and the door was locked. Three of the men returned to the Watergate Hotel to consult with Liddy and Hunt. Sturgis and Gonzalez picked the lock, taped it open, and proceeded to the sixth floor. Frank Wills finished dinner and made his round, checking for tape on other locks as he had been instructed. At the B2 level, that's down in the basement, he found the doors had been retaped. He left the tape in place and returned to the lobby where he met Walter Hellams, a security guard working for the Federal Reserve Board, who had just arrived to conduct a routine check on the board suite on the eighth floor. Wills asked Hellams whether he should call the police. Hellams said he should, as it was clear a burglary was underway. Wills first called Bobby Jackson and then, at 1:47 a.m., the Washington Police Department. Officer Carl Schaffler, Sergeant Paul Leeper, and Officer John Barrett were undercover near the Bayou nightclub on K Street Northwest, less than two blocks from the Watergate. Schaffler was in disguise, wearing shoulder-length hair and hippie clothes. A radio call came in at 1:52 from a police dispatcher to head over to the Watergate. Leeper and Barrett suspected a typewriter heist. Thefts of IBM electric typewriters had been a recent problem throughout the city's commercial district. Wills met the officers and showed them the tape he had discovered on the B2 basement door. Hellams told them about a burglary that had taken place recently in the eighth floor suite of the Federal Reserve Board, and together they climbed the stairs to the eighth floor, where they discovered the tape on the door. They made their way down to the sixth floor and found another tape door. Entering the hallway, Schaffler noticed an open window onto a balcony. "It was our experience. These guys will hide anywhere," he later recalled. "They are like roaches." He crawled out onto the narrow balcony, expecting to bump into one of the burglars, but instead he saw a man across the street observing the scene through binoculars from a room at the Howard Johnson. And just as Schaffler crawled back into the building, he heard Barrett shout, "Freeze, police, you are under arrest." Schaffler watched from behind a pillar as five men stood and raised their arms above their heads. "We're expecting thieves," he recalled, "and I got five guys with sport coats." The men were speaking to each other in Spanish as the officers directed them to speak English to no avail. It was only at that moment the officers looked around the room and realized they were in the offices of the Democratic National Committee. Why don't I show a few slides and then I'll take some questions. Let's see. Okay. So for some of you, may not think the Watergate is a beautiful building. This may inspire you a little bit. This is from the original files of the architect. His name was Luigi Moretti, a grand Italian personality. And this is one of his studio's personal designs for the Watergate. And it just has this movement and it's designed to be inspiring and dramatic. And Moretti actually had an interesting observation. He felt that he was like Charles L'Enfant, somebody who he had admired. And he had an opportunity to be a European that would leave his mark on America's capital. And so this is from his studio. And then this is, see down below, this is a model from his studio. And what's interesting about this, I think, is on the right, that's the original design for the Kennedy Center. And it looks like either a banjo or a clamshell or something. That was all glass with the steps going right down to the water. And Moretti's instructions were to make sure his new building harmonized with the Kennedy Center, and that was the design he was given. That was the original design by Edward Durell Stone. The design is later changed for economic reasons, mostly to become the sort of rectangular that we see now. But by that point, Moretti was already wedded to his design, and for a number of reasons, including the ability to give his design would give every apartment basically a view of the water. There are no right angles at all in the Watergate design, and that's intentional. That's to give the sense of movement and drama. And on the outside of the building, so up to the left and right, facing the city, the building is fairly flat, and facing the water, it's very open. So the building itself is actually transitions from the formal part of Washington to the natural part of Washington, Potomac and Rock Creek Park. And then also Moretti is Roman. So this is how a Roman building is laid out. If you're in Rome, you see a severe, flat, official surface to the street. And when you walk through the doors, you are in a garden and it opens up and embraces you. This is a color sketch that hung in the Watergate sales office for many years. This was shown to prospective buyers as part of the whole layout of the sales division. And a couple things that are interesting here is in between the buildings, you see these there's what are called Pompeian villas. So the original plan was to have like these little mini mansions patterned after the houses of Pompeii in between each of these office buildings. And that is one of the compromises that had to be made in order to get the building approved, was to get rid of those, make them more open space, shrink the building by a few stories. And then on the far right, that single building there, if you recall a couple of slides ago, that is now two buildings, and that was also a compromise. The Kennedy Center felt the original design came too close to the Kennedy Center and needed to be shrunk, and then they cut the building in half and pull it away from the Kennedy Center. This is a cartoon that was in the Washington Star in the midst of the fight over the Watergate. And so you see, this is Luigi Moretti in a Roman toga, of course, which all Italians would be wearing to government meetings. And on the floor, you see a design that says Watergate Town Project. That's actually a sketch of the model that we just saw. And Società Generale Immobiliare is on his tunic. And Fine Arts Commission is the group he's Moretti had to persuade to support the building. And they were very skeptical and very negative. The papers, Time, the Star, and the Post were very pro Watergate. It really had this split that the city wanted the land built. It was derelict property. The District of Columbia wanted it built, wanted the tax revenue, and the federal government was dragging its heels. And so the original caption for the cartoon was, "Perhaps if it looked a little more like this." And that's the Leaning Tower of Pisa, of course. This is LBJ on his tour from July 1967, touring the computers in the ground floor of the Democratic National Committee offices in the Watergate. And I, when I was checking with R. Spencer Oliver about the people involved, he confirmed who everybody was, and he said, oh, by the way, those computers never worked. moving to the Nixon years, this is from the Life magazine shoot. This is the Gossip Salon. This is the hair, the Watergate Salon. It's still there today. Parts of it look like this. That is the famous Martha Mitchell in the middle, talking the controversial wife, the outspoken wife of Attorney General John Mitchell, major figure in the Watergate history and in the book. With her is her daughter Marty holding their dog, and she's talking to Kathy Stans, who was Maurice Stans's wife, this is where everybody in all the Nixon ladies would go down to get the latest and greatest info. This is Mr. Stans in what he called his Africana room. And he liked to go on safaris and bring things back. And so Mrs. Stans made sure that the knives and things were kept in the study. I've actually been in that study, interviewing the current owner of that apartment. So it's surrounded by all of his safari souvenirs, and he used to, in the evenings in the summer, set up a movie screen by the pool and show films that he took of his safaris. And a guy named George Arnstein said, if they weren't racist, they were definitely condescending. This is working out at the Watergate Health Club. The president is marking National Physical Fitness Month tomorrow. Tomorrow is National Physical Fitness Month, so we're releasing this tomorrow. We're putting that on the web. In the back is Nancy Lammerding, and she has got her arm in a cast. But she, with the bouffant hair, she was considered the most beautiful Nixon campaign staffer. And this is, let's see, we got one. What we got? Okay, and this is Jacob Javits diving into the Watergate swimming pool. And a friend of mine passed along a note from a reader in the book. He said, I like the book, and it even made those Nixon people seem kind of fun. And I don't think I would dispute that, but that's this was sort of the heyday. And there was this funny moment in 71 where the Washington Post writes a story about the Watergate and calls the Watergate a glittering Potomac Titanic, and means it as a compliment. And the idea that it's this technical marvel, and the cast and crew are the best, very high end group of passengers, and the story concludes that there is a difference. There is no steerage, and there's no iceberg ahead. And of course, there is an iceberg, and it's the break-in of the Democratic National Committee. That's, of course, the iceberg that awaits the Watergate. So this is a photo taken on the 17th through the glass, looking into the suite. And this is back at the Watergate Hotel. That's Carl in his hippie vest as they are gathering evidence that should be suite 214. There's 314 and 214 control and staging for the break-in. This is the Monica watch. So right in front of the building, right in front of them is the parking lot exit that Monica would have been using to go to and from meetings, depositions, what have you. Watergate was very kind to Monica. I interviewed several people about those years, and people said, that could have been our daughter. We just, we knew the mom. Monica's grandmother has an apartment at the Watergate. Her aunt has an apartment. So there's this attachment to the family. And so when she was under siege there, they did their best, I think, to to give her some privacy. And because the place is built as a city within a city, she could actually have a fairly normal life. She could go to the bookstore. She'd go get her hair done without having to leave campus. And when she left, she gave everybody a personal thank you note in Watergate South, thanking them for being so kind to her and apologizing for the attention that had come to the building. I mentioned, and this is a photo from the Watergate Hotel was closed. It was closed for about 10 years, and it's the Watergate Hotel was going to be turned into apartments or a combination of apartments and a boutique hotel. And it was a five-year fight over what should exactly be done with the Watergate. And those plans get put on hold because the Watergate's one of the first casualties of the Great Recession. The financial engine behind the developer and behind this project was Lehman Brothers. And so I got to interview the man in charge of the project, Michael Darby, and he told me about what it meant to, you know, to hear about Lehman Brothers and realize that this, you know, one of his big projects, a jewel in his crown, really was lost, and what it was like to try to, you know, pull it together. But as I mentioned earlier, my goal was to write a biography of a building. And so when I read a biography, what I'm looking for is like, what are some of the takeaways from that person's life that I maybe could bring to my own? And this photo sort of sets that up. At various times, the Watergate residents, Watergate owners at one point at the hotel to turn it into a British hotel and said, we're open, we've just remodeled, and here are all of our features, and didn't mention the Watergate break-in at all, and got kind of mocked. But then when the Watergate residents themselves were trying to place the whole complex on the National Register for Historic Places, and because they wanted to protect the Watergate, they wanted to guard against major changes, or they were very fearful that this converting the hotel to condos was just the beginning of the tearing apart of the Watergate, and they wanted to try to keep it together. And so as they're finalizing the documents, working with this woman named Emily Eig, who's an architectural historian, to put it together, she gets the call and says, we would like to remove from our application any reference to the Watergate break-in. And she said, you know, I have to advise against it. You to be registered, it has to be architecturally interesting and of its best in, you know, of its period, but it also has to have historical significance, and that's it. And so there's this back and forth in the building, and they finally relent and they say, okay, go for it. And I think that's then the registration is granted, and it goes on the National Register. And I read the Park System paperwork on it, and they said not only is the scandal took place, but that what takes place there becomes part of American political history. And so that also became part of the reason why the Park Service decided to save the Watergate. And so I think that's probably the lesson. If you think of the Watergate as a person, is like, you know, if something happens to you, you get a curveball, you could pretend it never happened and people just think you're strange. But if you accept it and sort of incorporate it into your life, you can probably survive it and keep and live another day. And that's, in fact, what has happened with the new owners of the Watergate Hotel. This is, you remember that photo a little earlier of Carl in the hippie vest? It's probably in this room. And this is called the Scandal Suite. The new owners of the Watergate Hotel put a lot of money into remodeling it. They really embrace the Nixon era. They actually created this whole suite you can rent, which is basically a 1972 office. It was decorated by the costume designer for Scandal. I stayed at the Watergate to launch the book. And when you are on hold to the front desk, they don't play music; they play Oval Office speeches from Richard Nixon. Great. And that's what I got. So why don't we take some questions? Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
Just in case there are any investors in the audience.
Yeah.
How much does the junior one bedroom go for now? It went for $17,400.
So I think it's in, I think there aren't very many of those. What happened is a lot of people bought them and started combining. I've been to some apartments and I would be walking through somebody's two bedroom. They say, oh, I've got extra kitchen because I bought the studio next to me. It's probably in the threes, something like that. The penthouses were like in the 200s. In San Francisco, if you say that apartment's in the threes, we're not thinking 300,000 in San Francisco. So it's, you know, 3 to 4, something like that. And some of the apartments are quite grand. They're inexpensive. Yeah.
All right. I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that are listening to Joseph Rodota, did it again, the author of The Watergate. So who would like to ask the first question?
I don't really have a question. My family owned apartment 710 North and Watergate East next door to the Mitchells. And so I have lots of stories. I just wanted to mention, because I regularly saw them and everybody else in the cabinet, and you had to wade through security to get to your own apartment and that sort of thing. But what I was going to say is there's a certain irony, because when All the President's Men was being filmed, Robert Redford stayed on the same floor, which was the 7th floor, which is a duplex, and he stayed on the floor where Mitchell had resided a good part of the time while he was filming All the President's
Men. I have a Robert Redford All the President's Men announcement that will be going out next week on Twitter. I will not spoil it. I've actually been in that apartment, in John and Martha Mitchell's apartment, while it was being listed. And I got sort of walked through the whole thing. There's a story in the book about about a woman who goes into the apartment to buy a couch, and she's supposed to not know who's owns the apartment. And after a few minutes, she figures out she's in John and Martha Mitchell's apartment, agrees on the price of the couch. Her broker, the furniture broker lady, leaves and to go get the movers, and a few minutes later, there's keys go into the door, and John Mitchell has come home. So this woman had to run through the apartment and hide in a closet and wait for John to finish his day, and then take off. And it was like this Lucy and Ethel moment, really. And then also, I went to the famous Martha Mitchell bathroom, which is, you know, Martha Mitchell was sort of famous for late at night getting up out of bed, going down the hall, picking up the phone and placing phone calls to reporters, and then hanging up and going back to bed. And the phone was missing. And it was it's because the family had decided not to convey the phone, and they actually kept the phone. And so it's now, they recreated the wallpaper, and it's displayed in one of the nephew's home in Palm Springs in a secure Lucite case.
So our current president got his texting habits from
Mitchell. Exactly, a little bit.
Thank you very much for your talk. You didn't tell us who you are or why you were in Washington, but this was a walk down memory lane for me, because everyone you mentioned I knew.
Oh, sure.
Including Betty Bradley.
Oh, wow.
And it's very interesting, because I lived, obviously, in Washington, in a pretty high-profile kind of life. Washington was extremely bigoted, number one. The Northwest was the only place to live, and the Watergate came in, which bridged the Georgetown, which is Northwest, with the Potomac and a little bit of the business community. So when you speak about radical bigots, I cannot even describe to you what it was like, but I had the name Campbell at the time, and that was waspy enough. And number one. And number two, now, George knows I wrote a book about Rome, and that particular Immobiliari Associazione, who that was organized by the Vatican, had the Vatican's banker as the go-between, who happened to be Roberto Calvi, who was murdered, hung under the Blackfriars Bridge many years later. And that money was propaganda due. So since you don't know about the company anymore, it was swept under the carpet. But I thought your whole presentation was wonderful. But I'd like to know what you were doing in Washington at the time. And I'd like to know what you're doing now.
So in the book, I tell the story of the collapse of SGI. I actually am one of the few people who actually read all the minutes of the board. And I had them translated, actually, from Italian into English by my researcher, who had written four books about Rome. And so in the book, I tell a major story about a man named Michele Sindona, who is a central figure in the collapse of the Franklin Savings and Loan and also the collapse of SGI and the banks that he controlled in what was called at the time Italy's Watergate. I was in Washington, in Watergate once as a kid. In the 80s, I worked in the Reagan White House and in a couple of federal agencies. Also, I worked on Capitol Hill. I ran rapid response and research in the Reagan White House before coming out to California in 1988. And then while I was working on this, I just took my company. I have a consulting company, this strategy and research consulting. That's my day job. And we had a Washington office, which I opened and ran for a while. It was fun. Actually, it was sort of timed. My son headed off to UC Santa Barbara, so I was an empty nester, and so I dropped him off, and then I moved to Washington, and then right around the time, but it just happened to be, as 4 years later, I moved back, which happened to coincide with his graduation. I also have a daughter, so I'm not ignoring my daughter who's standing there. So I just took 4 years and got out of Sacramento and decided to spend some time back in D.C. and kind of shake things up a bit for the business and for me personally, which worked out really terrifically. Yeah, and I would love to learn about know more about your book about Rome. Great, and thanks for your question.
Any other questions? We have time for one more.
I have a question on that last photo. There was in the last photo in cold blood on the farthest right corner. Do you see that in cold blood? that's Truman Capote. What does that refer to in terms of the context of the break?
So that's he's like 66, 67. I don't know why they've put it in there. I didn't do the room. So, there's the Nixon, Douglas Brinkley's Nixon tapes book. Very good observation.
I was going to say, you win the award for being attentive to the picture. Yeah. All right. That's great. Thank you very, very
great,
much.
Great. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion.